Our knowledge of the development of the lodge is hampered by lack of records. It is generally believed that until at least the 1660s, lodges were not permanent, but were simply groups of Freemasons brought together for the purposes of initiating a candidate, what has become known as an occasional lodge. From the little evidence we have, it would seem that it was thought essential to have a copy of the old charges present at an initiation, and that at least the charges, if not the whole document, were read. Why people were initiated, and what being a Freemason at that date meant, are questions which still have to be answered. It's not until 1726 that we have extant minutes of a lodge which was purely speculative. These belong to a lodge constituted at the Swan and Rummer Tavern in Finch Lane, London, on the 2nd of February, 1726. Sadly, the minutes reveal very little, being mainly a list of dates on which the lodge met, with details of the meeting place and lists of those present. A few of the minutes show the lodge balloting for candidates and working ceremonies. The entered apprentice and fellow craft degrees were often worked on the same evening, but the Master Mason's degree was rarely worked. Meetings were held fortnightly, and attendances averaged between 15 and 20 members per meeting. Officers were limited to a master, senior and junior wardens, treasurer, secretary, and a tiler to guard the door of the lodge. All officers were elected and served for 6 months, elections and installations usually taking place on the festivals of St. John the Baptist on the 24th of June and St. John the Evangelist the 27th of December. Although elected every 6 months, it was common for the master to be elected for more than one period. But there is nothing to indicate that the installation of the master included any sort of esoteric ceremony. From the 1730s, more lodge minute books survive, and together with other evidence, they enable us to build up a picture of how lodges came into existence. The first step was to petition the Grand Master to be allowed to form a lodge. If the petition was granted, the Grand Master, or his deputy, would summon the petitioners to meet him, and they would be formally constituted into a lodge. If the new lodge was to meet outside London, the Grand Master would send a written deputation to some local worthy brother, authorising him to summon the petitioners and to constitute them on behalf of the Grand Master. A summary of the constitution ceremony as practised by the Duke of Wharton as Grand Master is given as an appendix to Anderson's 1723 constitutions. The proposed master of the new lodge was presented to the Grand Master, or his representative, and the Grand Master then asked the petitioners if the proposed master was their unanimous choice. This being answered in the affirmative, the Grand Master declared the lodge duly constituted and appointed the first master. The deputy Grand Master then gave the master's charge, to which the master had to submit, whereupon he was installed and presented with the constitutions, lodge book, and his jewel of office. The new master then chose his wardens, who had to be approved by both the Grand Master and the petitioners, who were given the warden's charge by one of the Grand Wardens and then installed by the master. Once this was done, the constituting officer signed a certificate of constitution, which was returned to the Grand Secretary so that the new lodge could be registered and entered on the engraved list of lodges. Once formally constituted, the lodge could begin its work of making Freemasons. Until 1757, lodges under the Premier Grand Lodge had no formal document authorising them to work. Their authority to meet was the act of constitution by the Grand Master and their being registered with the Grand Lodge. In 1757, the Premier Grand Lodge adopted the Irish and the Ancients practice of issuing warrants. Issued by authority of the Grand Master, the warrant was the instrument permitting the lodge to meet and function as a lodge of Freemasons. The warrant designated the first master and wardens and empowered the lodge to elect their successors. It did not, however, bring the lodge into existence. It still had to be formally constituted. The Ancients had a slightly different practice. When a petition for a new lodge was submitted, a dispensation was issued to the petitioners, allowing them to meet and make masons. If they proved that they could successfully hold and govern a lodge, a further dispensation was issued, permitting the holding of an emergency grand lodge for the space of 3 hours and no more. If in London, the actual grand officers would preside. If in the country, the dispensation would designate certain local brethren to act as grand officers for the occasion. The emergency grand lodge was opened, and the dispensation for holding it, together with the original petition and the warrant for the lodge, were read. The petitioners were then asked if they agreed to submit to the terms of the warrant, after which the Grand Master, or his representative, would declare the lodge duly constituted and proceed with the installation of the first master and wardens. Probably as a result of the Irish influence introduced by Lawrence Dermot, the ancients began to issue warrants to their lodges as soon as their first Grand Master was installed. The warrant was of immense importance. No lodge could be considered as regular without a warrant, and the document had to be present at every meeting for the proceedings to be considered valid. William Preston, in the first edition of his Illustrations of Masonry, included an appendix incorporating the manner of constituting a lodge, which he expanded in the 8th edition, which formed the basis of the present consecration ceremony. It was incorporated in the 1815 edition of the Book of Constitutions, but did not gain wide acceptance until the mid-19th century. This was possibly because Grand Lodge had no occasion to use it, for between the Union and 1850, only 2 new lodges were warranted in London, and the constituting or consecrating of new lodges in the provinces was the duty of provincial Grand Masters. When more new lodges began to appear in London, the consecration ceremony was quickly adopted, and in 1864, the Grand Secretary sent a circular letter to all provincial Grand Masters, in which he stated that the earliest possible opportunity ought to be taken for consecrating the lodge after the Grand Master's signature has been affixed to the warrant. Since then, the consecration ceremony has been essential, and the lodge does not come into existence until it has been consecrated. Although the consecration ceremony incorporates non-denominational prayers, it is not a religious ceremony in any sense. Its purpose is to dedicate the lodge to the great architect and, in the words of T.O. Haunch, it is the Masonic rite by which a new lodge is blessed for and dedicated to the purpose for which it is regularly constituted, that is, the practice of Freemasonry. Tracing the development of the ritual is as difficult as tracing the origins of the craft itself. Because printed rituals did not appear until as late as 1838, and because the 18th century and earlier Freemasons had a marked reluctance to commit ritual to paper, our knowledge depends very much on manuscript aides memoir and printed exposures, the reliability of which must be called into question as they were produced for profit and to entertain the non-Masonic public. Certain versions of the old charges contain evidence of the taking of an oath and the giving of signs and words. 4 manuscripts of Irish and Scottish provenance, dating from 1696 to 1714, give details of a brief ceremony, but not all ritual historians are convinced that they are evidence of Masonic ritual, being probably operative in origin. In the 1720s in England, we begin to get printed exposures appearing in newspapers or as broadsheets. The earliest appeared in the Flying Post, a London newspaper, for the 11th to the 13th of April, 1723, and is known as the Mason's Examination, a piece of doggerel which implies the existence of the 3 degrees of apprentice, fellow, and master. The 3rd degree is believed to have been a late development originating in the 1720s. The first minute of the working of the 3rd degree comes not in a lodge minute book, but in that of the rather grandly named Philo Musicae et Architecturae Societas Apolloni, the Apollonian Society for Lovers of Music and Architecture, the members of which were all Freemasons. Their minutes reveal that on the 12th of May 1725, Brother Charles Cotton Esquire, Brother Papillon Ball were regularly passed masters. There is no doubt that this was a reference to the working of the third degree, for Cotton is known to have been initiated and passed to the second degree in a regular lodge at the Queen's Head Tavern, Hollis Street, in the Strand, of which the Duke of Richmond was master, at the same time being Grand Master. The proceedings of the Philomusici were, of course, completely irregular, and they were strongly reprimanded by the Grand Secretary. From 1726, we begin to get references of lodges working all three degrees. The making and second degree were often conferred on the same evening, but the third degree took some time to gain acceptance. In many issues of the engraved lists of lodges in the 1730s and 1740s, there are lodges referred to as master's lodges, and it's believed that their function was purely the conferring of the master mason degree. Throughout the 18th century, there was no real necessity for anyone to go through anything other than the initiation ceremony, for that qualified them to make claims on the charity fund. It is not until 1730 and the publication of Pritchard's exposure, Masonry Dissected, that we have any detailed indication of what all three ceremonies contained. From 1730, we have no further information until the publication of two further exposures, Three Distinct Knocks in 1760 and Jarkin and Boaz in 1762, which show a certain development having taken place. After that, we begin to get more authoritative information in the syllabus books for William Preston's lecture system, Brown's Master Key, and the publications of William Finch from 1801 onwards, from which we can deduce the ceremonies of the three degrees. What these various sources tell us is that the ceremonies themselves were fairly short. In essence, the candidate entered, took an oath of fidelity and secrecy, and was given the word and sign. The greater part of the meeting was taken up with going through the catechetical lectures, in which the ceremonies, principles and tenets, and symbols and emblems of the craft were expounded and moralized upon. If the evidence of Pritchard and the 1760s exposures can be accepted, they show the catechetical lectures to have been fairly short and simple, with a minimum of symbolism. The last four decades of the 18th century, however, saw a growing interest in the philosophy of Freemasonry, resulting in the publication of works like Calcott's Candid Disquisition, Hutchinson's Spirit of Masonry, Smith's Uses and Abuses of Freemasonry, and Preston's Illustrations. The influence of these works, and Preston's lecture system, gradually led to the catechetical lectures being greatly extended, with a greater emphasis on moralizing and symbolism. The early 18th century in England was a great age of clubs and coffee houses, and in many ways organized Freemasonry was little different from many other clubs and societies which then existed. Lodge meetings were usually held in a private room in an inn or tavern, and there was very little difference between the actual meeting and the social board. Apart from the items necessary for the actual ceremonies, no special equipment was needed for much of the meeting, which generally took place with the members seated around a long trestle table. The normal administrative business of the lodge and the working of the catechetical lectures would be done at the table. As well as carrying the symbols of Freemasonry, the table would hold food, wine, punch and ale, tobacco jars, and churchwarden pipes. Eating, drinking, and smoking would take place throughout the meeting, except when the actual ceremonies were worked. Once the business of the meeting was concluded, the Masonic items were removed from the table, and the landlord brought in supper, at the conclusion of which the lodge would be closed. The years immediately before and after the union of the two Grand Lodges in 1813 were to bring further developments and great changes in the ritual. As a prelude to negotiations for the union, the Premier Grand Lodge in 1809 ordered its lodgers to reverse the alterations made in the words in the late 1730s. It then warranted a special lodge of promulgation, whose brief was to examine the ceremonies and determine how they differed from those practiced in Scotland and Ireland, and, by implication, the rival ancients' Grand Lodge. Conscious of the obligations they had taken, the members of the Lodge of Promulgation did not officially write down their deliberations, but from an examination of the Lodge's minutes and other official and unofficial manuscript records, we know that the installation of the Master with an esoteric ceremony was recognised as a true landmark of the order. Deacons became mandatory lodge officers, alterations were made in the ceremonies of opening the lodge in each degree, and the ceremonies were brought into line with those of the ancients. The work of the Lodge of Promulgation paved the way ritualistically for the union of the two Grand Lodges. Once the union had taken place, further ritualistic alterations had to be made, resulting in the warranting of a special Lodge of Reconciliation, whose brief was to complete the reconciliation of the two former systems and to bring about a standard form of ritual. Again, nothing was officially written down concerning the work done by the Lodge of Reconciliation, but some recently rediscovered manuscripts show that a new arrangement of the ceremonies was produced and demonstrated, and then completely rearranged in 1816. Rather than completing the reconciliation of the two former systems, the Lodge of Reconciliation greatly extended the simple 18th-century ceremonies by including material from the catechetical lectures, which gradually dropped out of use. This extension of the ceremonies had three principal effects. The production of longer, more impressive ceremonies required a special room for them to be worked in, resulting in the development of lodge rooms reserved specifically for lodge meetings. This development into more dignified ceremonies also led to a separation of the meeting itself from the refreshment, which became a separate formal dinner or supper held in another room than the lodge. More important was an essential change in the nature of the meeting itself. The ceremonies and their teaching of the principles of Freemasonry became the whole basis of the institution and not simply entrance requirements for a benefit society. The aim of producing a standard form of ritual was never achieved. As the revisions of the Lodge of Reconciliation were not officially written down and not allowed to be published, the new system was passed on by demonstration and word of mouth. This combination of the method of promulgating the new system with a failure to suppress local traditions resulted in a variety of workings of the same basic rituals in English lodges, which makes visiting all the more interesting. Most other Grand Lodges have a rigidly controlled ritual, which is practiced by all their subordinate lodges, and in which no alterations or differences are permitted without the sanction of the Grand Lodge itself. In England, having settled the basic ceremonies in 1816, the United Grand Lodge has chosen not to interfere in ritual matters unless basic principles are involved, believing that each lodge has the right to decide which working it will adopt and how it might vary it to suit itself. Provided that the basic landmarks and outline of the ceremonies are used, Grand Lodge does not interfere in details of language and performance of the ritual. The installation of a new master is an annual festival in each lodge. Although the installation ceremony has an esoteric content, it is not a separate degree. It's believed that initially the installation was simply the formal placing of the master in the chair of the lodge and his investiture with his jewel of office, without any additional secrets being conferred. The earliest evidence we have for an esoteric installation comes in the 1760 exposure, Three Distinct Knocks, reputed to show the practice of ancient lodgers. It is clear by the 1770s that some lodgers under the Premier Grand Lodge must have been practicing an esoteric installation, for by that time, having been master of a lodge was the qualification for exaltation into the Royal Arch. By the 1810 decision of the Lodge of Promulgation, the Premier Grand Lodge accepted the necessity of an esoteric installation ceremony for the master, and held special meetings so that the present and past masters of lodges could be properly installed. The format of the installation was settled in 1827, but the problem of the so-called extended ceremony of installation, which includes a formal opening and closing of a board of installed masters and the conferring of additional signs and words, was to rumble on throughout the 19th century and was not finally settled until 1927. The master of a lodge has to be elected by a ballot of those members present at a specific meeting each year. The mastership is the highest honour which any lodge can confer upon one of its members. Since 1811, all candidates for election as master must have served the office of warden for at least 1 year. Before the union, the master was usually elected and installed every 6 months, but it was not uncommon for one master to continue being re-elected for a number of years. On occasions, elections were hotly contested, and it was not unknown for a losing candidate for the mastership to resign from the lodge with his supporters and either join another lodge or petition to form a new one. After the union, the present regulation was introduced whereby no one can serve as master for more than 2 consecutive years except by dispensation of the Grand Master, which is only given in exceptional circumstances. The master rules the lodge and is responsible for arranging and conducting the work during his year. He has the sole right to appoint his officers, with the exception of the treasurer and tiler, and has a casting vote when voting on a proposition results in a draw. At the conclusion of his year, after installing his successor, he becomes by right the immediate past master of the lodge and sits on the left of the master to assist him during his year of office. The principal officers of the lodge, the master and wardens, were derived from the guild system. The senior and junior wardens assist the master in the ceremonies and in ruling the lodge. The junior warden has the responsibility for visitors to the lodge, in particular checking visitors who are unknown to the lodge to ensure that they are regularly made masons. The secretary of the lodge keeps the minutes of the meeting and is responsible for preparing and issuing the summons for each meeting. The treasurer of the lodge has always had to be elected annually by ballot of those members present at the election meeting. He is responsible for the finances of the lodge, but any expenditure or raising of fees and dues can only be done by notice of motion, followed by a resolution appearing on the lodge summons and a vote in open lodge. In the 18th century, when the treasurer physically looked after the lodge's money, a number of lodges appeared to have had little faith in their treasurers, despite having elected them, and insisted that they signed a bond, a surety for the sums entrusted to them. The tiler, or outer guard, is the last of the original lodge officers. His duty is to stand guard outside the door of the lodge, to keep out intruders, and to prepare the candidates for each degree. In the 18th century, he was provided with a rather fanciful Turkish costume, complete with turban, which was later replaced by a caped coat and tricorn hat, abandoned in the 19th century. In the days when lodges drew their membership from a particular small locality, it was the duty of the tiler to attend on the secretary and personally deliver a copy of the summons to the meeting to each of the members. Before the introduction of tracing boards, it was the tiler's duty to draw the lodge, with chalk, on the floor, when a ceremony was to be worked. The lodge was an oblong enclosing a drawing of the emblems and symbols of each degree. The designs became standardized, and painted cloths were introduced, followed by painted boards, tracing boards, one for each degree. The tiler did not, however, have to remove his drawing, for, as the exposures of the 1760s reveal, the candidate, be he ever so noble a gentleman, was provided with mop and pail to remove the drawing to prevent non-masons from seeing it. The tiler is usually elected by show of hands. In many Masonic halls, there is often a resident tiler who tiles all the meetings in the building and acts as its caretaker. The office of chaplain is what is termed an additional office. That is, the master may appoint one, but it is not mandatory for him to do so. Nor is it necessary for the chaplain to be a clergyman, as he has no religious duties to perform. His only function is to give the non-denominational prayers at the opening and closing of the lodge and at the beginning of each of the ceremonies. If no chaplain is appointed, the prayers are usually given by the master. Deacons are first heard of in Ireland in the early 1730s and were introduced from there into Ancients lodges by Lawrence Dermot and the Irish founders of the Ancients Grand Lodge. It was long believed that deacons were not appointed in lodges under the Premier Grand Lodge, but recent research has shown that while not common, there are instances of deacons being regularly appointed in a number of Premier lodges. The deacons today have two functions. The senior deacon acts as a messenger between the master and senior warden and is guide and conductor of the candidate in the second and third degrees. The junior deacon acts as a messenger between the senior and junior wardens and is guide and conductor of the candidates during the initiation ceremony. The inner guard, as his name suggests, guards the lodge door from the inside. His duties are to guard the door, to admit latecomers, and to admit candidates for each of the ceremonies, having ascertained that they are properly prepared and qualified to enter. The title was introduced at the union of the two Grand Lodges in 1813, prior to which the duties appear to have been carried out by the junior warden or a steward. It's not certain what duties the stewards performed before the union. They may have attended on the wardens when deacons were not appointed, guarded the inside of the door, and looked after the refreshments. Certainly since the union, they have had no ceremonial function other than being ready to stand in for an absent junior lodge officer, their services being reserved for the festive board. Their duties at the after proceedings vary from lodge to lodge according to how the meal is arranged. In some lodges they do nothing, in others they will serve the wine at dinner, and in the provinces where a Masonic hall has its own catering facilities, they will often serve the meal. The director of ceremonies, with usually an assistant director of ceremonies, is the guardian of the ritual and ceremonial of the lodge, an important task as the ritual has to be learnt and the officers may not use their ritual books. His duties are to ensure the smooth running of the ceremonies, prompt the officers if necessary, and deal with any ceremonial matters such as processions and the reception of distinguished visitors or latecomers. In some lodges, the office is still styled Master of Ceremonies, a hangover from pre-union days. Considering that brotherly love and relief are two of the great principles of Freemasonry, it's surprising that the offices of almoner and charity steward are fairly recent. The almoner first appears officially in the 1884 edition of the Book of Constitutions. His duty is to look after the welfare of the members of the lodge if they fall sick or on hard times, and also the welfare of dependents after the death of a member. A good almoner will check on members who have missed a few meetings to ensure that they are well and reports to the lodge on any who are sick. The charity steward was introduced as recently as 1975 and looks after the collecting of donations for either the lodge charity funds or for the major Masonic charities. Working with the treasurer, he looks after and suggests disposals from the lodge charity fund. Music has been a part of Masonic meetings since the early 18th century, and today the master may, if he wishes, appoint an organist. His main purpose is to provide incidental music for the ceremonies, in which he has a great freedom of choice, provided that he avoids overtly religious items which could give offence to anyone present not of a particular religion. The lodge officers form a hierarchy, leading from steward to master. In most lodges, the offices of treasurer, secretary, and director of ceremonies are undertaken by past masters, who stay in those offices for a number of years to provide continuity. In most lodges, the additional officers, chaplain, almoner, charity steward, assistant secretary, assistant director of ceremonies, and organists, are not progressive and may be held either by past masters or by members who may not wish to proceed to the master's chair but still wish to be of active service to the lodge. Today, whilst the working of the ceremonies may vary from lodge to lodge, the basic format of the meeting will be the same. Each lodge meets on specific meeting dates, and a meeting must be held regardless of whether or not there is a ceremony to perform. The number of meetings held a year is at the discretion of the individual lodge when it is formed, and may only be varied by agreement of the members and by alteration of the lodge bylaws. On average, London lodges meet 4 times a year, and lodges in the provinces 8 times, although some may meet every month or every month except July and August. The secretary has to issue a summons for each meeting, giving the agenda to be followed. The members and their guests meet at the stated time, and the lodge is ceremonially opened. The first item of business is the reading, confirming, and signing of the previous meeting's minutes, after which the order of business may vary from lodge to lodge. The Book of Constitutions limits the number of candidates who may be passed through a degree at any one time. At least 28 days must elapse before a candidate may progress from one degree to the next. Apart from ritual, the meeting is taken up with the business of administering the lodge. Candidates for initiation or joining membership have to be proposed at one meeting and balloted for at the next after the details have appeared on the summons. The proceedings of Grand Lodge, and in the provinces the Provincial Grand Lodge, have to be reported, and any correspondence from either read and dealt with. It's customary for the lodge almoner to report on the well-being of absent or sick members, and to make recommendations when cases of need are discovered. Whilst the master and treasurer may have authority to dispense small sums, most financial business of the lodge has to be agreed to by the members on propositions by the treasurer. Once a year, the master, treasurer, and tiler have to be elected, together with auditors and members for the lodge committee. Most lodges have some form of committee, which has no authority to make decisions of its own, but is a forum for discussing lodge business, the programme for the year, the interviewing of candidates, donations to charity, on which it will make recommendations, which then have to be voted upon by the lodge, usually after notice of motion has appeared on a summons. Whilst the majority of lodges are solely concerned with ritual work, there are some lodges in which the only ritual performed is the opening and closing and the annual installation of the master. These lodges fall into 2 groups: research lodges and those whose membership is limited to installed masters or provincial grand stewards. The purpose of research lodges is the bringing together of those interested in research into the history, traditions, and practices of Freemasonry, and the main work of the meeting is the presentation of a paper on some aspect of Freemasonry, usually followed by a discussion. Installed masters' lodges and provincial grand stewards' lodges are a means of continuing on a formal basis the fellowship developed during their year of office by those who have been master of lodges or provincial grand stewards. The work at their meetings usually takes the form of a talk on some aspect of Freemasonry, or a demonstration of one of the ceremonies as it was performed in the past, or as it is worked under another grand lodge. In the middle of the 19th century, there arose a number of what became known as class lodges, that is, lodges whose membership was limited to a particular group. For example, school, university, and regimental lodges, those whose members came from a particular profession or whose members had a particular vocational interest in common. Unfortunately, such lodges have an inbuilt weakness, for the success of a lodge depends on a regular supply of candidates, and if the membership is limited to a particular group, that supply may dry up. Since the end of the First World War, it has not been possible to limit the membership of a lodge, and many lodges which started out as class lodges have abandoned their original limitation on membership. It's a well-known fact that Freemasons wear distinctive regalia, and the development of that regalia has paralleled the development of the lodge. The earliest reference to regalia comes in the Premier Grand Lodge minutes for the 24th of June 1727, when it was ruled that the only jewels were the square for the master, the level for the senior warden, and the plum rule for the junior warden, which were to be in gold or metal gilt for the grand master and grand wardens, and silver or base metal for the lodge master and wardens. On the 17th of March 1731, it was ruled that aprons should be of white lambskin, lined and edged with garter blue silk for the grand officers, and white silk for all others, excepting the grand stewards, who were permitted to line and edge their aprons with red silk. It was also ruled that jewels of office were to be worn around the neck, appended to garter blue silk ribbons for the grand officers, white silk ribbons for lodge officers, and red silk for the grand stewards. Human nature being what it is, from the 1750s, individual members began to decorate their aprons. Initially, simple hand-painted designs were added to the plain white lambskin, a square encompasses, or the Grand Lodge arms. From the 1770s, the designs become more and more elaborate, incorporating a multiplicity of Masonic symbols, often combining those of the craft with those of other degrees as they became more widely practiced. Many examples survive in the Grand Lodge Museum and other places of hand-painted, embroidered in silk or beadwork, or printed aprons. By the 1790s, standardized designs were being produced from engraved plates and sold penny plain or tuppence colored. As with aprons, so with Masonic jewels, as Masonic medals are called. To the original three for the master and wardens were soon added jewels of office for the secretary, cross pens, the treasurer, a key, and tiler, a sword. When deacons became more usual, they adopted the winged Mercury, or Hermes, bearing a caduceus, possibly to mark their position as messengers. After 1750, individual members began to adopt their own unofficial jewels, usually incorporating a great number of Masonic symbols, not necessarily confined to the craft. Two basic styles evolved, now known as plate and pierced jewels. The former were flat, circular, or oval plates, often in silver, on which the Masonic symbols were engraved. The latter were similar plates with the designs fretted out. Special presentation jewels were manufactured to mark particular services to a lodge, many of them being in gold or silver, decorated with enamels, and set in borders of paste or brilliants. The union of the two grand lodges brought about the standardization of craft regalia and jewels. A board of works had been set up to manage the property and furnishings of Grand Lodge, but its first task was to design patterns for standardized regalia to be adopted by all members. They worked quickly and presented their designs at the March 1814 meeting of Grand Lodge. The designs were accepted and have only been varied since by the addition of new emblems for additional officers as they have been introduced. As a result of the 1814 regulations, the design and wearing of regalia has been strictly controlled by Grand Lodge. No jewels, other than those of the craft or the Royal Arch, may be worn as part of the craft regalia, unless they have been approved by the Grand Master. As well as the formal business, fellowship forms an important part of Freemasonry, and lodgers have a varied social life. But that must be the subject of our next chapter.